The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So make a little time if there are any questions about practice, and then get into second part of the talk that I began last week.
This is pretty much the first time doing meditation.
Okay.
I saw everybody close their eyes, so did I. Then yeah. I kind of just doze off.
Yeah.
Then I opened my eyes, it was about 8 o'clock.
Right,
so
right.
So I wasn't sure what's going to happen afterwards.
Yeah. A couple things. This class is not a great place to learn how to meditate. Exactly, as in the sense that there are introductory classes, 6-week series, some of which are online and some of which are offered periodically throughout the year, and including, I think every Thursday at 6:15, right? There's a beginner's basic instructions, and that's the place to actually learn a bit. This sort of presumes you have some foundation to practice, but closing your eyes, perfect. That's one for one.
That's the least I can do.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have suggestions? Do you have any helpful hints for dealing with sleepiness, or I guess it's called torpor?
Sloth,
I've heard that
and torpor,
before.
Right.
When practicing.
How does it come up for you? How does it arise?
Well, I'm doing my best effort, and then, you know, I get sleepy, and then I realize that that's happening. So, yeah.
And does that happen in morning and evening, or just, is it more in the evening that it?
Just the evening.
Just the evening, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, part of it is just about being a little strategic about when we practice. That's part of it. But just a kind of few basic suggestions, most of which will only be marginally helpful, are kind of spine hanging for like this, can take some breaths and really focus on the inhale rather than the exhale, can narrow the focus of, you know, to get even more, try to get more precise with, if you're attending to the breathing, narrow the actual space in which you're focusing, open your eyes. And you can also practice standing, and I've done that from an old meditation injury, not by choice but by necessity, really, on retreat. That's a totally viable way to practice, and it takes, obviously, it's a gesture of renunciation too, to actually get up, but you're most welcome to do that. And something that one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, has said is that we don't have to fight all aspects of the tiredness. There are some things like the relaxation and the equanimity that's often present amidst fatigue that is quite valuable, actually. And so we don't have to work against that. What we are working against is the sinking mind, the sinking consciousness, which the visual imagery gets very intense, and there is a sense like my last resource, like the last thing that I have to deal with anything is sinking, you know. And yeah, it's tricky to work with, I think.
I found that if I go for a walk before meditating, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. It wakes you up, that perfect.
It's so easy and obvious, yeah. But yeah.
Just, yeah, be clever about it. We don't have to master fatigue. That is sometimes a practice. We do sometimes on retreat practice through the night. There are monastic traditions that practice through the night, which is vivid, and about 3 or 4 a.m. rolls around, and the body is just like, talk about the armies of Mara, you know, the kind of embodiment of suffering in the Buddhist tradition. Yeah, intense. Yeah, sure. Yeah, Sarah.
Yeah, this question came up kind of from your story about your friend who went on retreat and was trying to observe the precept of no sexual contact and then was consumed by thoughts of sex. And so what is the purpose of observing precepts on retreat? Yeah. If they're only a month or 10 days and you go straight back to the behavior once you return,
yeah,
are you hoping to maybe come to a different state while on the retreat or reap some sort of benefit afterwards?
Right.
What?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there are different, you point to a couple key issues. I think there are different intentions for why we keep the precepts on retreat or what we're trying to accomplish in doing that. And some of it is benefits for that actual retreat itself, and some of it is intended to have some spillover value into post-retreat life. So on retreat, one of the beautiful qualities of actually keeping the precepts is that it creates just a general ambiance of safety that includes the safety of not being the target of sexual advances, for example. And in establishing that kind of safety, what it actually does is it allows... it creates this sense that, okay, we're not doing all these particular behaviors, but as a consequence, I'm freed up to really have whatever experience arises, because I know there are these firm lines that we are just not crossing, but that actually makes it safer for the intensities of desire or aversion or whatever to actually fully flower. And in that process of these energies fully flowering, if we're acting them out, we can't see the mechanisms of craving, gratification, release. We can't see how those processes actually unfold. If every time I have a scratch, an itch, excuse me, I just scratch, I actually don't see that whole gestalt of being, you know, sort of persecuted by the sensation and the kind of crescendo of agitation and then the kind of compulsive reaching and the relieving. It's actually hard to see the way that craving and renunciation can function in our lives. And so some of the reason not, that's part of why we don't scratch those the various itches. And then there is a kind of over the long term, there is a kind of momentum that seems to be built in terms of renunciation, and we're literally practicing, like we would practice an instrument. We're practicing renunciation, and we actually something gets stronger in us. Initially, there may be a little bit of a backlash because there's a kind of, maybe you know this, it's sort of like sometimes you go to a day-long meditation and then you come home and you're just like a wild beast, like freight train of unconsciousness, and sometimes I don't know why this is how, but it's like there's this kind of backlash, and that actually makes sense in the context of the notion that we have a kind of finite amount of self-regulatory juice, and we were spending it all day, right? To not flop around and pick our noses and or do whatever we might be doing, like to be dignified, to be a Buddhist teacher, It's like that takes some amount of regulatory energy. And then there can be that kind of backlash where it's like all spent. But that's a kind of transient phase. And I think the trajectory over time is towards actually that practice of renunciation strengthens something in us. And over time, it's not maybe some of the deep desires don't fade away totally, but many of the like little desires and medium strength desires, and sometimes maybe the big ones, really do fade away. And it's like we don't know why, we don't remember letting go, we don't remember why or how we let go of something, but we sort of survey our life in the last year or few years of practice, and we can see like, oh, it's easier being human. I want less. The intensity of the wanting, it burns less. Mm. It distorts my behavior less. Mm. And that's so some of what we're practicing on retreat is for that momentum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Maybe one, anybody else before we... Yeah, please.
I tend to pick my favorite, or I tend to pick what I'm going to do in the sit before I start. Mm-hmm. But I do find that the loving kindness type of practice seems to be, it seems to at least fill my heart with this sort of radiant glow the most of all of them.
Yeah.
So I do tend to go between that and breathing and sometimes auditory focus. And I do a variety of them, but I'm wondering, would it kind of lead to stagnation to sort of pick one of them and say, I'm going to do this one most of the time because it seems to bring out the most, seemingly... progression or in the practice, or does that kind of lead to stagnation? It's really kind of better to keep a variety, or does it really not really matter what? Maybe sometimes in your life one is better than the other. And
yeah, mostly my suggestion would be not to make a big deal of the choice. I think it's totally fine just to commit to metta practice. And there are many people, and myself included, have done that. That's been a primary practice over a period of months or even some people many years. That's all they do. And it's really what I was alluding to at the beginning of the sit, sincerity, that will determine when if when you should be doing something else, if it feels not necessarily stagnant, but maybe it feels there's actually an element of avoidance or something in a certain practice, or you can feel like you're, the choice to do one thing is being propelled by greed, hatred, or delusion. You know, like this is what our sincerity is, it gets curious about. But I would, just in hearing you talk about the metta practice, I would make that a primary practice. That sounds useful. Yeah, thanks.
So lately I've, is on? Yeah, okay. I've been just really cranky at work, kind of just sarcastic and snapping at people. Is there a practice that's maybe a little better for anger?
Yeah. You know, I think with... it's interesting. There's a difference between moods and emotions. And it's obviously related, but one of the differences, the way it's been characterized, is that moods, it's emotions more short-lived. We know the onset. We can usually identify the particular triggering factor in it, whatever happened in the world or inside us that triggered the emotion of anger. But moods onset in a much more subtle way, and they become to a certain extent like the water we swim in, and you know, there's this I was in a David Foster Wallace graduation speech, where I don't know whether he just made this up, but it's like one fish is swimming this way and a couple other young, you know, an old fish swimming this way, two young fish swimming this way. The old fish says, "Hey boys, how's the water?" Then the next frame is the two young fish saying, "What's water?" Right? Water. Moods are like the water. And they are kind of hard to see, but what they do is they sort of lower the threshold of provocation required to act out, you know? And the way I kind of experience it is like my mind just feels a little crispy, you know? It's just like a little crispy. And I think of it as like the idle point is different, you know? Like cars idle ideally at like 500 RPMs or something, and then if they're idling, you know, 3,000 RPMs or something, as something's going on. And that's sort of how it feels biologically to me. Like there's the idle point changes. And in terms of working with it, I think part of it is being... Is attending to the mood before the emotion. So we actually start to get clear on that, the subtle, it's more subtle than the anger or irritation with a colleague or something. It's like this subtle, higher idling level. And it's actually, I find, helpful and important to keep checking in with that, to actually see that. And it sometimes takes some, we're not always able to look right at it. We sort of have to sense our moods. It's like the attention has to get a little bigger, because it's not super obvious always what's actually happening. but we can actually come into contact with the flavors in the mind and body that constitute the mood of agitation, irritation. It's a big topic, and I can't get into it now. But one of the key points would probably be physiologically deactivating oneself, finding ways of practices that are actually soothing, they may not be looking directly at the anger, but it's like we actually need to find ways of soothing ourselves. And that makes the mind-body environment less of a kind of tinderbox, you know. And so whatever practices that you've developed, whatever ways in which you can experiment, that would be, I think, one of the key places to begin.
One more thing about that, Matthew. Yeah. You did a very good series on anger. That was my first interface with you, 2 years ago or so?
Yeah.
Just to be aware of that, because it's on Audio Dharma, right? That series? It was either 2 or 3 Thursdays, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were very, very instructive, I think, and useful.
Okay. Good, good. Yeah, I was an angry teenager, so the 80s, a lot of aversion, yeah.